You're listening to Viewpoint Alabama, a public affairs program from the Alabama Radio Network about the people, places, and events that impact our state.
I'm Jim Faraday. This is Viewpoint Alabama. Our guest is Dr. Scott Bollier. He is the chairman of the Economics and Finance Division at Troy University, and we're discussing the ongoing efforts to remove the sales tax on food in Alabama. Dr. Bollier recently wrote an op-ed piece that's been featured in some of the state's newspapers. Dr. Bollier, welcome to Viewpoint Alabama.
Hey, Jim. Great to be on.
Doctor, for those who did not get a chance to read your article, outline, if you would, some of the points you made regarding Alabama's sales tax on groceries.
Sure. So one of the things that I point out right at the beginning is that a study came out in 2013 that looks at how regressive states as a whole are when it comes to their tax code. And what we mean by regressive is just how much the tax code hits the poor. The poor live on less incomes than wealthier individuals, so taxes sometimes have a disproportionate effect on them. That's what we mean by regressive tax codes. Alabama's 10th, according to those rankings, the 10th worst in terms of how hard we hit the poor. And when you dig in and you look at the numbers, we're one of only seven states that hits citizens with the highest possible state sales tax on groceries. Most states in the country don't apply a sales tax on food at all. We're still hitting it as hard as we can. And we're a fairly poor state compared to many of the other states that are on the really regressive list. And this is something that I just looked at and said, you know, it seems like an obvious place to improve our rank, more importantly, to help the poor.
Doctor, why does this tax hit the poor especially hard? Does this get back to the issue of a limited income for these folks?
Yes, it does. So if you think about it, you know, an individual living on, say, $20,000 income is going to buy, you know, almost the same amount on, spend about the same amount on food as someone living at a far higher income. Someone living on $100,000 isn't going to go out and spend, you know, half of that on food. But someone living on $20,000 might come close to spending, you know, 25 or 30% of their income on food. So as a share of one's income, food gobbles up a much larger fraction for a poor person. And then if you add to that the sales taxes, which are 4% from the state, and then most localities tack on, you know, another 4, 5, 6, maybe even 7% in some localities around the state, it really adds up to a big chunk of money.
Doctor, there have been efforts over the years to repeal this tax, but it never seems to happen. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a frustrating issue when you look back at Alabama's history. Back in the early 1990s, Joey Kennedy, who works at AL.com, won a Pulitzer with some of his co-authors for exposing some of the regressive aspects of Alabama's tax code. And he won a Pulitzer for it and received a lot of attention, yet many of these taxes remain the same. One of the big things that I've noticed in raising the issue again is that people ask those of us who are saying it's a bad, inefficient, immoral tax, they ask even more of us, and I'm writing about it this week in my column, they ask us to figure out the revenue piece. So if we eliminate or cut the sales tax on groceries, we're being asked as well to find replacement revenue. And that's actually putting way too high a burden on reformers. Reformers who point out that a tax isn't fair and it's an inefficient tax should be able to just make their case and have lawmakers to change it. But often what you see is them asking you also to find the revenue that would be missing. In this case, it's about $300 million.
Well, we've had some lawmakers try to repeal the tax. Republican State Senator Gerald Dial of Lineville, I know he had a bill that would replace the lost revenue by raising the tax on other purchases. And then you had Democrat State Representative John Knight of Montgomery, who wanted to repeal the tax and replace the revenue by eliminating the deductibility of federal income taxes on state returns. Of course, neither of these bills has passed. Do you favor either one of those approaches, or is there another way you would like the repeal to proceed?
Well, you know, it's anything that makes the code simpler is preferred. You know, many states are moving just to one form of taxation as opposed to multiple forms. We have a sales tax and an income tax. I personally wouldn't mind seeing just one rate applied, you know, one form of taxation as opposed to both. So simpler is almost always better when you're looking at states and their ability to grow and attract businesses. So that's kind of my default preference. What I think the important thing missing from some of these discussions about reform is that when you're cutting taxes, keeping revenues neutral or positive isn't necessarily your goal. Sometimes cutting taxes, the purpose of them is to actually cut spending for the government as a whole, and that isn't part of the conversation at all. This notion that we have to keep revenues at the same level, I find very problematic.
Doctor, you mentioned in the article that we tend to view governments as money-making entities.
That's right. You know, this notion that we need to find very cheap ways to grab money for the state government. You know, this idea that if there's a way to increase revenues at low cost on people, because many people aren't voting or they don't even see the taxes, often you see fees and hidden forms of taxation across states, that this is what a government ought to do, and that a larger bottom line on the revenue is a good thing. And few people are asking, what am I getting for all of these additional funds going into the state government? And that's what I'm trying to do in some of this writing.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Bollier of Troy University, and this recent op-ed piece concerns Alabama's sales tax on groceries and efforts to repeal it. Dr. Bollier, you actually outline in kind of an interesting cycle that happens when states look to the poor for tax revenue. I was wondering if you might discuss that.
States often have hidden taxes that they place on the poor. The grocery tax is one that's actually a little more obvious, but another one that, you know, I haven't written about yet, but that the poor people know firsthand, is often if you're incarcerated, you pay fees that are court fees and fees based on getting your license back and a lot of other things that most of us have no idea and never confront if you're staying out of the way of the legal system. But again, these are things that hit the poor particularly hard. They're actually very popular politically, so they stay in place. And what you get out of this is the poor paying money into the government, and then basically that government cycling back to them money in the form of transfer payments. I would much rather see a system where we're confronting poverty head-on, and we're not engaged in these gimmicks of trying to take money, and then mainly just cycling it back to them in the form of transfer payments.
And what are some of the arguments you have heard in favor of maintaining the current level of taxation on groceries?
It's mainly this revenue argument, this idea that if we're not taxing groceries, there will be a shortfall in revenue, and where is it that you would like to cut then, you know? And we're running this claim that we're running really thin budgets and we have no room for cutting is the one that leads to inaction. Yet, if you look at total expenditures and total revenues in our state, even since the Great Recession of 2008, they're up about 25%. So there's plenty of spending, and revenues have risen steadily over time. Somehow we were able to get by in 2008 at 25% less total expenditures in the state. Those keep climbing, and there's never this question of when is enough enough when it comes to spending.
Do you think there is a better chance for a repeal once the legislature is past the political cross currents of an election?
Maybe. You know, the issues that the state confronts on the expenditure side are so big that it's hard to forecast exactly what will happen, but I'm kind of skeptical of any real change to the tax code. In fact, my concern would be that taxes are going to go up on things like groceries or a sales tax, as opposed to just remaining where they are now. Some of the realities on the spending side, due to the fact that lawmakers just do not want to cut or keep spending flat, are very real. There's a major problem with our prison system in the state. There's educational expenditures that we have committed that aren't going away, and we have healthcare expenditures that are growing rapidly over time. So when you look at those headwinds, the risk is that the poor are going to get hit even more with higher grocery taxes and possibly a higher sales tax in the next few years.
But Dr. Bollier, this kind of dovetails into another issue that you've written about in a different op-ed piece, and that is a state lottery. This is an issue that has been discussed over the years here in Alabama, like the tax on groceries, and it has resurfaced once again this time because the Democratic candidate for governor, Parker Griffith, has included it in his platform. Tell us, if you would, a little bit about your view on a state lottery.
Again, this is an issue where my perception of how candidate Griffith is thinking about it is he's viewing the state as this money-making entity. Let's find money at low political cost. Let's not offend anyone in the way that we extract money from people. Let's take it in and then use it either to shore up budgets or to spend on a new pet project. I spent my first 6 years of my career in Georgia, where they have the Hope Scholarship Program, and that's all lottery funded, and it's very popular among middle class and higher income individuals. But it's coming primarily, if you look at the data, on the backs of poor people and people who aren't very educated. One-third of people in Georgia never play the lottery. One-third only play when the lottery gets really, really big, and then it's just kind of for, you know, the sake of saying, I just might win $100 million tonight. So they're the very infrequent players. The other third are people who are largely addicted to it. And I don't have a problem personally with individuals wanting to gamble or going to Las Vegas, or if we wanted to have a vote on having gambling in the state. The issue I have is with the state, this entity that supposedly has, you know, moral authority and, you know, some kind of legitimacy, saying we're going to be in the business of providing the only gambling option in the state besides Native American casinos.
Has this, your experience in Georgia, watching that lottery and the Hope Scholarship, did that effectively operate as a wealth transfer from poor citizens to middle and upper middle class people?
Absolutely. You know, and that's one of the real concerns I have, is that it was not funding, or it was infrequently funding, a poor student's education. What it was doing was transferring money from inner city neighborhoods where people were playing the lottery heavily to the suburbs and to, you know, individuals who were sending their kids to University of Georgia and actually could easily afford college already. One of my friends and someone I know from the University of Georgia who's an expert in this area looked at the data on what was happening with the Hope Scholarship before and after. Parents in Georgia were saving for college, and they were mainly well-off parents already. So what happened with the Hope Scholarship was it just basically gave them additional funds to now give their kids even more things in their early 20s, things like cars or their own house off campus as opposed to living on campus, God forbid. And it basically was transferring money for a very questionable social need. If you think about the lottery as helping advance the good, that's really questionable in terms of what it's doing as far as value added.
Well, I'm sure you've heard the old line that we've heard over the years, that it's also a tax on people who are bad at math.
It is. And that's something I point out, is that it's folks who really are staking their hopes to something that, in a probabilistic sense, you know, in a sense of the odds, is stacked heavily against them. And what you see when states go down the path of embracing a lottery is a lot of heavy advertising, just a lot of hopes and dreams that are being rolled out. You know, the one-off anecdote of someone winning five times is thrown right in your face as, this could be you. And in fact, the odds of winning even once are very, very low, let alone five times.
Of course, they never feature commercials with the people who have lost, which would be far more numerous.
That's right, except that small amounts of losses spread across largely poor neighborhoods. You know, a very effective story in this whole discussion would be to just show the thousands of dollars being thrown away out of people who can't afford to be spending it on these kinds of activities.
Well, Dr. Bollier, you've given us a lot to think about, much food for thought, and if folks have more questions or perhaps want additional information on anything they've heard today, they can go to your website, right?
That's correct. They can go to my website. I have contact information there. I write weekly for AL.com, and there's a piece connected to all of this appearing on AL.com this week on tax cuts and then that other side of it, the revenue piece, so they can definitely follow that as well.
All right, and we certainly hope they do. Our guest has been Dr. Scott Bollier, Chairman of the Economics and Finance Division and Director of the Johnson Center at Troy University. And Dr. Bollier, thanks again for joining us here on Viewpoint Alabama.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to Viewpoint Alabama, a public affairs program from the Alabama Radio Network.
Hello, you're listening to Viewpoint. I'm Angie Norvell, your host. Today we're talking with Cindy Bond, post-secondary and career specialist at Hoover High School. Cindy, welcome to Viewpoint.
Thank you.
We wanted to talk a little bit today about our graduates. A lot of people are getting out there and ready to start their future. Most will have college on their mind. So what's the first step?
I'll tell you, it's a difficult time for a lot of students. I think they've spent, you know, the past couple of years doing everything they can to be best prepared for college, whether that's for admission or scholarship. And then it all culminates in graduation, and then they kind of have a now what do I do moment. And so a lot of them decide to go ahead and jump in and maybe take a summer class at their local community college, which I think is a great idea because it gives them the chance to start college in the fall with some college work under their belts. It gives them the confidence to realize, okay, I can do this. It's not, you know, it's just the next step up from what I've done as a high school senior. And they kind of enter college taking their full load of classes in the fall a little more ready, with a little more understanding of what's to be expected of them. I also have a lot of students that just work a summer job, and for that, for them, they're maybe saving up, going to help out with their tuition for the next year, or just spending money, or really taking that as an opportunity to get some work experience and an understanding of the day-to-day operations of what it is their career choices might be for the future. So, for example, I've got some students that maybe they think they want to become a veterinarian when they grow up. So they've taken a job, summer job, just working in a local vet's office. So just to kind of give them some contacts and give them an understanding of what may be expected of them one day. Other than that, there's a student that's having the opportunity just to spend some downtime with friends as they're all looking forward to going off to wherever they've chosen to attend college and spend some last time together before they get started in the fall, too.
Now, for me, after I got out of high school, I performed an internship that helped me to get to know the radio station that I was going to work at, and I wasn't paid for it. I was able to earn some course credit. Are those opportunities easily available for those who are high school graduates to perhaps take something that they've learned throughout the summer and put that towards course credit?
Not as much high school going into college. I will tell you, though, Hoover, I think, is a little bit unique. There's other schools, of course, in Alabama that have this, but we actually have academies within our curriculum. So a student would be taking, of course, their core classes, what's needed to graduate high school, but then they also have elected to choose to be in the healthcare academy or the law academy or engineering academy or business finance academy or IT academy or education academy. Within the high school curriculum, most of our academies require that the students complete an internship between the summer between their junior and senior year of high school. So a lot of our students have actually completed an internship before they ever come back to school to begin their senior year of high school. Now, that's not giving them college credit, certainly, but it just gives them another understanding outside of the classroom work, again, of the day-to-day tasks and activities associated with a particular career. So for those students, they're able to kind of be able to decide before they even start college, do I really want to major in this? Do I really like it? So sometimes the value in doing an internship is not just helping you realize what you want to do, but actually realizing what you don't want to do as well.
Trying to figure out one or the other. What about those young people who may have no idea where they want life to take them? Maybe they're floundering, or how can you help those students?
Well, we still, and it's not jokingly, but kind of laugh when we say it, can tell a student undecided is still the largest major in the nation for incoming freshmen. Sure. And I do try to take the pressure off a little bit when I'm working with my students and just remind them that it's very possible the career that they're going to have after graduating from college isn't even invented yet. With the way technology is moving, with the way global communications and business and everything else is going, there are jobs being created every day that never existed the day before. So for that student, we try to encourage them to look for a college that has a wide variety of majors, including things that they think they may like to do, but then also to understand that no matter where their college path will end, for the most part, every major has about the same 2 years' worth of core classes that mirror kind of what they did in high school of English, history, math, science, and to focus on that. And while they're getting those courses out of the way or learning in those courses, visit the Career Center that's there at every college campus. The college career centers have amazing opportunities from every type of career inventory to one-on-one counseling.
You're listening to Viewpoint. I'm Angie Norvell, your host, and we're talking with Cindy Bond, post-secondary and career specialist at Hoover High School. Now that the graduates are out of high school, what happens next? And we're focusing on college right now. As far as entrance exams go, Cindy, like those ACT numbers, are they a major deciding factor for a university?
They are. They really have become a large part of college admissions. Now, I want to tell you that we have many amazing opportunities within the state of Alabama for our students who want to stay in state, whether that's just because that's their comfort zone or for financial reasons, or because we have some opportunities here that are second to none. I will tell you, our community college system, which is the two-year colleges, are there to serve our high school graduates and prepare them to either go to work within a career technical field or go on to transfer to a four-year college and university. And a lot of the students that we were talking about earlier that they just don't have an idea of what they want to study at, they don't have an idea of what they want to do, or they just feel a little bit unprepared to step into a four-year college environment where they're going to be moving out from home, living on campus, and doing that kind of thing, choose to start at one of our two-year colleges here in the state. Financially, it's a little more affordable for those students. They can live at home because it's usually within driving distance of their home. And the same resources are available in terms of academic quality as well as tutoring and the career centers, that kind of thing. The nice thing about the two-year system is they are able to offer admission to students who graduate from high school with an Alabama high school diploma. And so the college placement test, the ACT or the SAT, is not necessarily a factor in admission for the two-year schools. Oh, okay. So for our students who don't do as well maybe on the ACT, or our students that don't even take the ACT, maybe they would choose to start at one of the two-year schools. Now, the two-year school would use high school grades, high school curriculum, as well as something called a Compass placement test. Upon transferring, that doesn't limit them to only being able to earn that two-year degree. They can actually, after completing that two-year degree, transfer on to a four-year college and finish a four-year degree without having taken the ACT. Now, for a lot of our four-year colleges, the ACT has become a large factor in admission, both public and private. Those schools are looking at high school curriculum, if they've taken the courses required for admission, as well as how the students did in those classes, and then they're additionally looking at those ACT or SAT scores. We're in the state of Alabama, having partnered with basically ACT and every student in Alabama taking the ACT while in high school now is a more commonly used test something that's more commonly spoken about, I guess, at any of the four-year colleges. But it has become a very important factor, not only for admission, but really for scholarship purposes.
Hey, Cindy, what about extracurricular activities? Does that make a more well-rounded student? Do they find that if someone's heavily involved in extracurricular activities, does that bode well for them or against them?
You know, in the general admission process, they're really the top things they're looking for are going to be the coursework curriculum, how they did in that, and then their standardized test scores. However, those extracurricular activities really can be pulled into this equation, especially for scholarship consideration, as well as a way to connect members within that university to that prospective student, to reach out to them, help them realize that, you know, if you've been really involved with Habitat for Humanity throughout high school, we've got that Habitat for Humanity here in college, and we know in order for you to be comfortable and happy, you want to continue that extracurricular activity. And so we want to make sure we connect those students to that organization. Same thing for athletics. They may not be playing for the college, but with intramural athletics or Greek life, if that's what they're interested in. So that high school resume is important. Not as important for admission at a public college or university. Now, when you begin to look at the really competitive colleges and universities, that also can become a factor in admission. And the more competitive colleges and universities typically are looking at more factors for admission. So they're looking at all the grade things, the academic coursework, but they're also looking at character, extracurricular, and trying to make an overall decision based on the whole student and what the needs of that university are. So for public universities, four-year colleges in our state, admission-wise, they're looking more at the academic profile of the student.
I see. We're talking with Cindy Bond, post-secondary and career specialist at Hoover High School, about our graduates and what they're facing. We're looking at every month, the State Labor Department lets us know where the jobless rate stands in our state. Now, numbers remaining about 6.7% for the past couple of years. Are you finding that those seniors graduating in the past couple of years have more job opportunities to choose from? Or is there intense fighting to get at what few jobs are out there?
I think it is really hard for our high school graduates to find employment. What we've got is a situation where many adults are going back to work, maybe retirees are going back to work to supplement their income, or as people the job market and the job employment opportunities became more and more precious, obviously those people with their education under their belt or having, you know, finished their education have been a little more successful in gaining that job. I've noticed this year especially is there are more students that are beginning to recognize the value of career technical education and seeking out those jobs that offer employment following earning a two-year degree, maybe the certification, something in welding, plumbing, electrician, or early childhood education, where you are a qualified applicant to work after completing a certificate program. I mean, I will tell you right here in the Birmingham area, we've got some community colleges that are putting out students prepared to enter the workforce and ready to begin earning their life salary. Lawson State with the automotive program that they've got there, Jefferson State Community College with their culinary program, or, you know, and that's just throwing out something that jumped to my mind, but some of the programs that are available really match the state's initiative of having graduates that are college and or career ready. And that's something that I've begun to really appreciate for these students, that they may not want to go on and earn a four-year degree and then go on to graduate school or professional school. They really are ready to work, but they understand they need the training, they need the specialization that they can be prepared to work in an environment of all the emerging business that our state's leaders have brought into Alabama. And I think that's a great thing.
Have you found that your students' attitudes towards life, or are they more optimistic about the future, or do they seem a little pessimistic?
I think our kids are definitely optimistic. I mean, it's hard not to be when you have a question about something and you can go to the internet and see what those answers may be, or you can see what opportunities may be out there. And I do think that our students are wonderful goal setters. You know, they can see, for the most part, the long term. They can have the long term vision of, if this is what I want to become, this is what it's going to take to get me there. And so I think there is a sense of optimism about it. I think the world that we're living in has opened up so many opportunities for our students. It's just a matter of being able for them to have the confidence and courage to step up and take it.
And when it comes to the class of 2015, what can folks listening now who maybe have a junior who's about to become a senior in high school, what can they do to get ready for the future and get that senior year put together properly?
Should be visiting some colleges and universities, taking that college tour, that college trip. And I would say also, if you do have a student that's kind of thinking, I'm not really sure, but I may be interested in something like radio and television, I would say to that parent, they need to make sure they're going to their school and talking to their grade level counselors and making sure if there is a course available.
I'm Angie Norvell. Thank you for listening to Viewpoint.
You've been listening to Viewpoint Alabama, a public affairs program from the Alabama Radio Network. The opinions expressed on Viewpoint Alabama are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or advertisers of this station. If you have any comments or questions about the program, please send an email to viewpointalabama@arnnet.com. You can also send a letter to the Alabama Radio Network, 600 Beacon Parkway West, Suite 400, Birmingham, Alabama, 35209. Thanks for listening, and please tune in next week for another Viewpoint Alabama from the Alabama Radio Network.